So how are all you survivors doing out there? Yeah, this is near the end, folks. We're getting there. You made it. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming and attending. I'm Fred Bonjour. I'm on your governing committee. I do weird things to beer it sometimes. I tend to make big beers. But we're not here about talking that. We're here about talking clubs. On the governing committee, I'm also on the club committee. So if you've got things, input, or whatever you think you like, catch me after, let me know, and we'll consider whatever. But we're trying to get more info out there for the clubs. But that's not what you're here about. Here we got a growing up, building a lasting homebrew club. How many of you guys are in a club? I kind of thought that'd be a bunch of you. Thank you. One of the things I like to tell people is join a club. You know, if you're a homebrewer, join a club because you're going to find someone there that has made every mistake you're going to ever think of making. And they can help you stumble through it and get, you know, resolved and the whole bit. So please, keep encouraging doing that. What we got here is we got Josh Weikert. Did I get that? Thank you. He started brewing in a late one, 2007. I thought I was late in 2001. Okay. But use it as means for staying sane in graduate school. Yep. What makes graduate school sane at all?
Nothing. But the beer helps.
The beer helps. Founding member of Stony Creek Home Brewers. We got a Stony Creek in Michigan. He assures me it's not that Stony Creek. He's meddled in every BJCP style. I guess the beer's getting to me a little bit. And is a Grandmaster Certified Cicerone. And let me qualify that. That's only the 2008 styles. He hasn't pushed the 15 ones yet. Regular contributor, author, brewing blog, you know, political science major, you know, go with it. His wife, Barbara, and a dog, Biscuit. Is that for the flavor?
Hey, she actually came with that name.
Okay, I give you Jeff. Josh.
Good afternoon, everybody. Let me pass along what, in addition to what Fred said, that it's great to see so many people here after, you know, the debauchery of last night. I'm actually surprised I'm here, to be perfectly frank. It's great to have you all here. I'm here to talk about homebrew clubs, and as we saw, pretty much everybody in the room belongs to one, which is not a big shocker, but it's always fascinating to me when I talk to people about their homebrew clubs, because you hear such a range of stories, and a lot of those stories have a lot of angst built into them, and people are frustrated with their club, or it's not doing what they hoped it would do, or they're the one who's trying to keep everything moving, and they're trying to hold it together with both hands. So the reason I decided to focus on this topic was that as a political scientist, I get to study institutions and the behaviors of human beings and why they do what they do. And when we apply just a little bit of that to homebrew clubs, there are a lot of good lessons to be learned. So without further ado, I'd like to start with this, talking about Alexis de Tocqueville. Yeah, it's going to be that kind of a day. By the way, later on, if you'd like to come up to the microphone and just share your political views on anything, I think that'd be great. I'd love to hear. I'm sure everyone in the room would really love that conversation. We start with Monsieur de Tocqueville here, he visited the United States in 1830 to study democracy in America. And the two books that resulted from that were a study for the French to teach them why democracy was good and how it differed dramatically from the aristocratic society they were living in. And what he noted, among other things, was that America was a nation of joiners. We liked to come together and congregate and do things together. And he said, in no country of the world has the principle of association been more successfully used or applied to a greater multitude of objectives than in America. We will form groups around anything, whether it's bowling or homebrewing or, you know, political causes or, you know, communities. Like you just named, we are a nation of joiners. And this is illustrated in the homebrewing community. There are more than 1,800 homebrew clubs in the U.S. alone as of 2015, which is great. But the bad news is that many of those really do seem to struggle. Because homebrew clubs are easy to start, but they're hard to maintain. And most of them start out as what we call charismatic groups. Now, charismatic organizations are organizations that are built around the efforts and personality of a single person. So picture someone like a Stalin, okay? That's a charismatic political leader. Or the president of your homebrew club is probably that kind of person, too. There's someone who, just by the force of their personality, is conquering a large country and deposing its other... No, that's not what they're doing. But they are organizing a lot of activity, and they put a lot of themselves into it. And people come to associate the club even with that person. Now, that's great at the beginning, but that's not sustainable. Because here's how this works. This is the short and happy-ish life of a charismatic club. First of all, when it's founded, everybody's happy. Everybody's excited. You have this small core group of highly motivated actors. You start doing things, and these ad hoc structures start to form. Maybe you decide, hey, we should have a golf outing. Hey, you know, Tom, you belong to the golf club. You know, maybe you should organize that for us. Oh, okay, I'll do that. And after a while, it starts to grow a little bit, and you start adding some members. You have, you know, your first joiners, you know, your friends, neighbors, family members, maybe people who already knew how to brew, and now they, you know, they realize you started a club, so now, all of a sudden it comes up. And after a while, you attract a few more people. And then you start getting walk-ins, because at some point you decide to, like, you know, start a Facebook page or something, or a website, and all of a sudden people start finding you. And you start having people show up, new people, people you didn't even know. And sometimes you end up with transfers, people who are coming in from other clubs, because maybe your meetings are a little closer to their house than the place they have to drive 45 minutes to get to. And your club starts to grow. But the problem is that in all that growth, there's not much commitment to the club, aside from that little core of excited people that started out originally. And those people start to burn out. They start to get fatigued. It starts to become problematic to, you know, organize things. Maybe they put in a lot of effort, but not that many people show up. And they start to roll off. They start to fall out of the club and its activities. And what happens then is you enter a period of almost permanent decline. It's very hard to lift yourself out of that. You lose all the energy you had at the outset. You don't have anybody organizing things. When they do, they're very small affairs. And all of a sudden, you're not attracting people. Maybe you're even shedding people to other homebrew clubs. And that's it. Because at the end of the day, you didn't really have a club, a capital C club. You had a lowercase c club. You had just a group of people that kind of slammed into each other for a little while. And that was kind of it. Now, if you want to avoid that, you have to actively avoid it. I mean, the upshot of this whole talk today is that you have to make choices that make it possible for your club to grow and succeed. That's not true. It's not that it can't happen by accident, because everything I'm about to say, there are exceptions. There are huge and successful clubs that sort of formed organically and nobody ever managed them, and maybe nobody runs the meetings. It can happen. And for that matter, even clubs where you have a high degree of interest in management and, you know, and steering, they might still fail. But for the most part, what makes clubs successful is when you have a club that is built around the idea of an institution. Institutionalism is really the answer to charismatic leadership. And just for a quick definition of institutionalism, thanks to Professor Sam Huntington here, writing in a great book, by the way, called Political Development and Political Decay. We're great at titles in political science. At least in America. In Britain, they're not. There's an associate of mine, a guy named Mark Franklin, he wrote a book called Voter Turnout in Industrialized Democracies After 1945. I think you can guess what that book's about. But we don't, yeah, but the American political scientists, we know a good title. But what he says about institutions is that institutionalism is characterized by stable, valued, recurring patterns of behavior. And my little addendum to this is that emphasize collective rather than individual identities. In other words, the club is no longer about those charismatic individuals who started the club. The club begins to be about the club itself, okay? And institutions, in brief, they have a deliberate and purposive identity. There are both informal customs and norms and formal structures and features. Now, when we think about other institutions in society, we might think about, for example, the institution of marriage. We use that term a lot. It's an institution, and it has a deliberate purpose. Obviously, that purpose, we all know, is to create legal and economic connections between two individuals. That is obviously the purpose of marriage, right? Socially speaking, it actually is. And it comes with certain formal structures and features, right? It's recognized by the state. It changes how you file your taxes. It gives you certain rights for hospital visitation. But that's not what marriage is. If you ask any person on the street, what is marriage, they would say it's about love, exactly. Yeah, it's about love, and two people meet each other, and, you know, in some cute way, and then they go on some dates, and then they get married, and then they have kids, and that's what marriage is. It's about sort of a shared life experience. But when you strip away all of that, and we talk about, well, what is marriage really? At the very bottom of it, it may be about love in the modern context, but when we think about what it is as a social institution, that's not what it is. but it incorporates those things as well. And it comes with all kinds of other informal customs and norms as well, doesn't it? I mean, there's this presumption of monogamy, of cohabitation, that you will appropriately lie to each other on occasion. Like when my wife, who has that sort of phosphorescent Irish skin, to quote George Carlin, comes out of a dressing room wearing like a pastel yellow dress, looking like a vampire who just got out of prison. I mean, she's so pale. I can't say, oh my God, that looks awful. I need to come up with some other reason, because I can't tell her what I'm actually thinking. So, and if I don't, I'm a bad husband. So these informal and formal things interact with each other, and we'll see the same thing in any institution. And the reason that works is because it allows both structure and flexibility. And that's what you're going to need in your club. So how do you go about building an institution? This is where we're going to start. You start with building identity. This is another great quote I love. It's organization is the mobilization of bias. I love that because it suggests that, by the way, is by a guy named E.E. Schatzschneider. And with a name like that, he had to be a political scientist, E.E. Schatzschneider. But what he means by that is that when groups form, they tend to form for a reason. They don't come together by accident. This isn't organic. It wasn't a bunch of people just hanging out on a street corner and decided to form a group. We all got together to do something. So you have to decide what that is, and you have to identify your group from the outset. And, you know, you have to look at purpose. And homebrew clubs might exist for any number of purposes. It might be to educate brewers, evaluate beer, encourage brewers to compete. It might be for social interaction. It could be for the production of beer, a big brewing system, something like that. But you have to choose that identity before you start to grow. Because if you don't, you're going to sort of be trying to retrofit your identity onto what people have joined up to. And that slows things down. If you choose that identity nice and early and decide this is what we're going to be, we're going to be a club that focuses on beer evaluation. Well, what that does is it guides your early efforts and lets you put those, at that time, very limited institutional resources to good work doing what you're trying to do, what you've decided to focus on, which also means that you have lower membership turnover because people are getting what they signed up for. And it also means that it's easier to get people to help you. And leadership recruitment is something we're going to talk about a little later. When choosing an identity and building it up, you have to think about, you know, the other clubs in the area. You have to think about your market. Are there other homebrew clubs? What do they focus on? Where can we find a unique niche? You might ask, are there breweries in the area? Are there homebrew shops who might sponsor you? Are there other civic and fraternal organizations you're going to be competing with for time and attention? If every member in your club is also a member of the Moose or the Knights of Columbus, you're now kind of, you know, competing for time with that person. So, I mean, you should be thinking about these things when you sort of set your goals. Then what you do is build up a culture. This is what happens after you have an identity. What you do is take that identity and turn it into a verifiable reality. Culture, loosely defined, is a pattern of behavior that informs future behavior and expectations. And culture, as I tell my students, is really very simple. It's just what people expect. Culture is just a set of expectations. I mean, if you're going to dinner at a 4-star restaurant, you know, and you show up in, you know, shorts and a tank top, they're probably not going to let you eat there no matter how much money you have, because you're violating the cultural norms of that place. And culture building can happen in deliberate and structured ways, but it can also happen in organic and natural ways. But you should focus on deliberate culture building, because the decisions you're making are establishing that. So when we think about clubs, you might think about member recruitment. How are you getting new members? Are you interested in getting new members? Are you actually recruiting and proselytizing and trying to get people into your club, or are you not? When you think about meetings, how often do they occur? How long do they last? What do they focus on? What kind of activities do you have as a club? Are they built around judging beer, brewing beer, talking about beer? It's nothing to do with beer except drinking it and getting together. I mean, you're going to have to make these decisions. And then you also have to look at this one as the leader of the club. What model of leadership are you going to take? Because this is going to stick around for a while. The reason we think of George Washington as a great president is not because George was a brilliant politician, because he wasn't. But it was because he was so good at this culture building, and he knew that everything he did from now on would define this office of the presidency. And so you have to think about that as well, because this is going to echo. Whoever's president after you is going to take on a lot of these same features. So you have to think about this. Are you going to be an autocrat? Are you going to hold everything to yourself and do all the work yourself? Is there going to be a gatekeeping model where you have a bunch of officers down below you and then they pass you information? Or is it going to be very open and collegial? Because each one of these is going to fit in different clubs. But again, you should be the one making the choice. And also, culture is built organically. You have to be willing to roll with the punches as the club evolves, as it grows, as the situation changes. You have to be willing to adapt so long as those evolutions don't conflict with the overall mission of your club. Okay? And as I say, your culture is built by an example and enthusiasm, or stay in character. You want to be like Daniel Day-Lewis as the president of this club. You want to act like this club is the most important brewing institution ever established. Because if you believe it and you act like it, so will they. The people in your club will pick up on this. Okay, they'll care about it. And if you want to, and if you don't think that homebrewers care about their homebrew clubs and really believe in what they can do, I would just refer you to what we saw last night. These clubs put in enormous amounts of effort for no personal reward or remuneration, just because they care about their clubs. And that's what our goal should be. The third thing we need to do here is build up a legal personality. This is the actual formal creation of your club. At a bare minimum, you should use bylaws. You should be thinking about this in terms of, you know, what the club does and how it does it, and writing it down, just because it makes it easier for the club to function, first of all. We don't have to invent as we go. But it also means there's transparency. If people want to know why something has happened, you can just refer them to the bylaws. And sometimes they're also legally required. But we'll get to that in a second. In terms of club finances, the first thing you want to do is get yourself an EIN, an employer ID number. And what that's going to do, sorry, that was like my Marco Rubio moment for that little inside politics joke there. You want to open, you know, get yourself an employer ID number. You go do this through the IRS's website. What this does, this is like the social security number of the club. It's a way to legally recognize it in some fashion. You can take that number, open a bank account for the club, and what that's going to do is promote, first of all, accountability in the finances of the club if somebody's running it, but it also means that you know, you can more easily transact business. You can buy shirts for the club. You can pay for expenses at your competition. And this way, you're not constantly reimbursing people. Okay. The third thing you might consider after bylaws and finances would be incorporation. In most states, this is a very simple process. It does vary from state to state. But in Pennsylvania, anyway, I know from personal experience, it's basically a two-page form with maybe three responses on it. This is not difficult to do. And the advantage of incorporation is it provides a form of protection for your officers and members and directors so they don't become personally liable in the event that things might happen at your events. Now, you can ultimately be held liable personally, even in the presence of incorporation under certain circumstances. It is possible to pierce that veil of responsibility. But usually those are things that involve gross negligence or malfeasance or, you know, wildly inappropriate behavior. And in that case, you know, you were probably had that one coming. And then the thing that many people sort of confuse with incorporation is nonprofit recognition. That's actually a very different thing. This is convincing the IRS in advance that you are a tax-exempt organization. Now, it's not required that you do this to be tax-exempt, but it simplifies any dealings you have with the IRS. It means every year, instead of having to file a tax return and explaining away why you should be exempt, what it means is that you simply file an informational e-postcard, which literally just says, we didn't bring in more than $50,000 this year. And if you did, then wow, you're just, I'm in awe. Yeah, then pay your taxes, exactly, then pay your taxes. At the end of this, though, we have this one last question of insurance. And this is something that comes up fairly frequently with homebrew clubs. We deal in alcohol. Well, we don't deal in it, but alcohol is present in a lot of our events. It can make people anxious. We do have insurance programs through the AHA that deal with insurance both for the club, for events, also for officers and directors in the event that they are held to be personally liable, which is, as I say, fairly rare. But for something like this, you really do want to talk to an insurance agent because this is very much a case-by-case operation. I would say, just as a matter of my own opinion, for most homebrew clubs, I doubt your club, assuming you're incorporated, has sufficient assets to warrant insurance. In the event you're sued, the only things that are fair game would tend to be the assets of the club, which for most clubs is not substantial. So I tend to think that it's probably more work than it's worth. But as I say, that's up to you and your club, and I encourage you to talk to a professional about that. Now, at the end of the day, once you do all this, what you have is a more persistent club. You have a club with a branded identity. It knows what it is and probably what it will be. It knows where it's going, and its members know. You end up with a cultivated culture, not something that happened by accident, but something that you worked on. And that behavior that you've built up and those patterns that build up probably reflect the ideals and goals and history of your club. In other words, it's something you can recognize and you've helped organize. And then finally, your club has an actual juridical personality, which means it can be treated like a person in a legal sense. Okay, the club actually exists as its own entity. So congrats. That's it. We're done. That's all. No, I'm kidding. Once you have a club, now you need to do something with it. This is when we go to the action part. What do you do with your club? Now, a lot of you are going to hear this and say, oh, you know, we already do this, we already do that. 85% of that was a waste of my time. Maybe it was, but I promise you the same 5% will hit different people. So I hope you come away from this with a couple of good ideas for your club. A lot of what went into this section of the presentation was derived from a survey I conducted after I found out that this proposal had been selected for presentation. I conducted a survey, because that's part of what I do for a living, of homebrewers. And I got 819 responses to an online survey. The group was geographically diverse. It was a little bit disproportionate to the Northeast where I live because more people knew me and, you know, were connected to me through Facebook and Twitter and whatnot. But it ended up being more than sufficiently geographically diverse. We got lots of responses from all over the country in every different region. And apparently the people in Montana think they're their own region. I had someone write, because I had a block to write in if I didn't cover you, and somebody wrote, Montana, we're our own region. Okay. So all the regions of the United States plus Montana. What I did was I sort of culled through this data looking, and I asked, what do you want your club to do? Do you belong to a club? Do you charge dues? Do you own equipment? Do you have a clubhouse? To just make sure I wasn't reflecting my own biases here. And what we found is that generally clubs do these 7 things. They meet, they educate, they evaluate, they compete, they brew, they socialize, and they give back. The first thing you're going to have to do if you're going to meet is you have to find a place to meet. Now, I'm sure most of your clubs already do that, but it probably will change over time. Stony Creek has had, I think, 4 different meeting places, just because circumstances sometimes warrant that. So when you're picking a place to meet, or when you're forced to pick a new place to meet, you want to look at geography relative to your membership, not just right now, but where it's coming from in the future. You want to think, well, it seems like our last 5 or 10 new members all came from this region or this area of our region. Maybe we should pick a place closer to there, because that seems to be where we're getting a lot of new members from. You might pick something based on its access. Is it easy to get to? How long does it take everybody to get to the meeting? You also want to pick a place, as I say here, where you can build a relationship. This is probably your most important institutional relationship, is between you and the place that you meet. And you want them to be supporters of beer and homebrewing and the craft beer movement. You want them to be flexible. You want them to have some discretion as managers or owners so they can accommodate you for not only meetings but other events. It's a very important relationship. Usually these are public venues, restaurants, bars, and brew pubs. I think that's an obvious reason. First of all, you get to sort of piggyback on their insurance, which is nice. You also obviously have access to beer for meetings. They're usually happy to have you because you're bringing in 30, 40 people, maybe even more on a, you know, Tuesday night. So they're happy for that. Sometimes you'll see breweries that have open space. That new tank farm hasn't gone in yet, and so they've got a lot of wide open space for brewers to meet. And very often I see this, where homebrew shops will actually form and sponsor and support clubs because they're self-interested. Because we all are. So it would make sense. If you have a club meeting there, they're going to buy their stuff from you, especially if you give them a nice discount. But all of these are places that are common for homebrew clubs to meet. Less common are these private venues, as in when you have club-owned real estate, which is rare, but it does happen. The wealthier clubs that I ran across did sometimes own an actual clubhouse. And then you also had some places that had borrowed space. I think one I found had a member or an officer who was worked for Boeing, and they had this wide-open hangar. And they can just meet there. So, I mean, you do sometimes see these private venues. But the point is you have to pick a place that meets the goals of your club, that allows you to meet comfortably, and hopefully, you know, is a place where you can serve alcohol legally. When we think about other things clubs do, education is a big one. It's a good idea to start and return to the basics now and again, both as you're adding newer novice members, but also as, you know, methods change and new information comes to bear. You can actually, re-educate your older members, your more veteran judges, or excuse me, brewers. And doing this, you can use your own talent, find out what people know, get them to participate. You can identify outside speakers like pro and amateur brewers, maltsters, farmers, people in your area, maybe who are industry figures, who own breweries or publishers or writers. And if you're lucky enough to live near a major, you know, university town, lately there are many that have brewing science programs. But even if they don't, I promise you, they have chemists and biologists and historians who study or work in beer. We've seen some of them actually here during the conference. And those are great people to get in to talk to your group. But in the event you can't do that, maybe you're very isolated or maybe no one likes you, What you can do is you can also have roundtable discussions within your group. And these don't need to be technical conversations. They can be about brewing systems and practices that people engage in on their own. So there's always ways to educate. And if you're lucky enough to have enough interest in it, you should definitely look into running exam prep programs, either for the BJCP to produce more certified judges or the Cicerone program, because this is helping your club by making your own membership much more expert than they might be otherwise. But more important than that is evaluation. This was far and away the number one thing that people wanted homebrew clubs to do for them. And it was also an area where a lot of homebrew clubs were kind of failing their members because about a third had no formal tasting and evaluation process in place. And in a statistical sense, the formality of that evaluation process was significantly correlated to the perceived benefits that people derived from their club. So the more structured your tasting and evaluation is, the more your members are going to appreciate it on average. Okay. You can limit it just to certified judges if you have them. I don't generally recommend that, although you might lean on those people a little more. But there is such a thing as the wisdom of crowds. If 30 people taste a beer and 25 agree that it's, you know, a pretty good beer and 5 don't, then there's some validity in that. You can't rely on it exclusively, but it'll give you some guidance. So you don't need to have certified judges to engage in an effective evaluation program. And you should also look at how often you're doing this. At Stony Creek, we do it every meeting. We always have. And for that matter, if you look at the next bullet point on focus, from the beginning until we got a little too large for it, we literally focused on one beer at a time. If we had 20 people at the meeting, we poured 20 samples. Everyone would sit quietly and smell it for a while and taste it. And then we would give feedback to the brewer and ask him or her questions about how they made it, what went into it, and tried to sort of make it better. Or just praise them for what they had done. But that kind of focus is really where people seem to be deriving the most benefit, that formal tasting structure. So that's what I would have to recommend. Another thing we do as brewers is compete on occasion. I'm sure many in this room are hoping that the competition ended well for them. I guess we'll find out tonight. But brewers compete. It adds an element of urgency and interest to brewing. It gives us a reason to brew outside of ourselves every once in a while. And they can take lots of forms. Intra-club competitions are a common feature where within the club you will have a competition. For example, we do 2 a year at Stony Creek, and it's become a bit of a tradition now that we do a Secret Santa competition where you pick an ingredient and a style, and you give that to another brewer in the club, and they must brew it. And if you're a nice person like I am, you give somebody something manageable. I think last year it was a rosemary ESP. I thought that sounded nice. For the holidays. Some people were cruel. For example, one of our brewers had to brew a kimchi Cal Common. It's worse than you think. Like, whatever you're picturing, it's worse. He made it well. It's just, that's the problem. He made it. You could really taste the kimchi. Ironically, by the way, he was our competition organizer, and he was the one who approved that combination. Because everybody had to submit theirs for approval, so it didn't get totally out of hand. But yeah, you can have those inter-club competitions, and it can be fun. But you also see inter-club competitions. Sometimes clubs in the same region will set up a competition between themselves as a, you know, for bragging rights or as a point of pride. We obviously have these open competitions where anyone can enter. We see these all over the place. NHC is obviously a big-time example of that. But most regions have some relatively large competitions in the 300-400 entry range or even larger. One thing we do at Stony Creek, which a couple other clubs have emulated, I'm sure we didn't invent this, but you know we've popularized it a little bit, is we hold duels. Members of the club can challenge each other to brew something, and if you're challenged to brew whatever it is, like a mead or an English pale ale, whatever it is, you must accept. Now you have to brew it. Now, if you're already in a duel, you don't have to keep accepting them, and we're capped. You can only duel so many times in a year. But it's a way both, again, to challenge people to brew, but also to, you know, encourage that sort of, you know, head-to-head competition to get everybody excited about it. Because the more you brew, the more likely you are to participate effectively in the meetings. But we'll get to that in just a minute. The one thing you do need to be cautious of when it comes to competitions is not to overly focus on competition as an aspect of brewing. It should be something that motivates brewers and makes them excited about brewing, but it shouldn't be the reason the club exists. And you want to make sure people who are not comfortable with that sort of competition and confrontation, you want to make sure they feel okay and realize that even if they don't participate, that, you know, it doesn't make them less of a brewer because they don't compete. All right. Another thing we do is produce beer as clubs. Some clubs actually brew on big systems, either a single, brew day where everybody brews the same thing on one huge system, one to three barrel system. Sometimes you'll have everybody bring their brewing equipment to one location and all brew a beer and put it all together. Sometimes group brewing and that element of, production involves buying ingredients in bulk. If you can find a friendly brewery in the area, they might throw a few extra sacks of grain onto their order and sell them to you at the same cost. Very often breweries have excess hops. They contract for a certain volume of hops, and if they can't use it all, then they're probably just looking to get rid of it. And we might also find that, it's helpful from a club perspective to teach people how to brew and aid them in the production of beer, either through their first few batches or when they're converting to all grain or to brew in a bag or when they just need, experience with new equipment like mills or presses. I mean, everything seems like magic the first time we see it, and then we do it once and we're like, oh, well, that was easy. But prior to that point, it can be very intimidating. And sometimes clubs actually own this equipment on their own. Many clubs buy big brew systems for the purposes of brewing for club events, and often there's a sharing of the product that follows. The next thing we do is socialize. This is the second most common thing that people said they wanted to get out of their club. They wanted this to be a social event. Beer is inherently social. And very often we see open club socials where people who are not brewers bring their family and friends in for some sort of social event. Most clubs have one of these at least annually. I like the idea of doing it semi-annually because what it does is it creates a higher degree of institutional buy-in from not just the brewer themselves, but also from his or her family. And friends and close associates. And it's also a good way to show that the club can be, a fun place to be, that it's not all talk about, cohumulones and, oxidation, but that actually we do kind of have a good time with this. In addition to these open events, there are also beer-related events you might do, but I'm sure no one is shocked by any of these, going to visit breweries, beer festivals, pub crawls, beer dinners, vertical tastings, whatever it is. I mean, we do a lot of beer-related socializing where we get together for the beer, but then it ends up being a social event. And sometimes clubs eventually evolve to the point where they do events just for fun. They might put together, camping trips or skiing trips or golf outings or game nights. We do a lot of game nights in Stony Creek. Big, big Cards Against Humanity fans. Stony Creek home brewers. And the more they drink, the better it gets. But yeah, you use your club as a mechanism for socializing. Make it a place people want to be and be a part of. They will develop friendships, and that really builds that glue that holds the club together. And then finally here, in terms of activity, is giving back. This is very much a last but not least sort of scenario. Clubs should be involved not only in their local brewing communities, although that's important, participating in conferences like this, on club night, holding, attending sponsored social events at local homebrew shops, but also going out into what I would term the real world and actually, being a force for good. And a lot of homebrew clubs volunteer at community events. They raise money for nonprofits. Maybe if you're having a homebrew competition, you might just add $1 to each entry and donate that to a local food bank. At Stony Creek, what we do is we donate money to a local regional library, and we also assist them with a beer and food pairing dinner they do every year so they can raise more money. It's good for your club because, obviously, it makes us all feel good, but it's also good for the hobby in general. When people see homebrewers out, it shows that we are not just drunkards, producing as much beer as we can and then drinking it until we pass out. We're responsible consumers of alcohol, and we, like everybody else, care about the community. If you do all of these things, and probably a lot of others I haven't even thought about, what you'll have is an active club. And to do that effectively, you need to make yourself at home, develop a good home base where you have a good relationship with that person who manages that place. You're giving members what they want, and this value is subjective. You need to know your own membership and how they identify the club and then give them that. And the idea is to be creative, but repeat what works. Because if someone has a great idea, I have up here great ideas don't matter. If someone has a great idea, but no one and everyone agrees it's a great idea, but then when the event actually happens, three people show up, then guess what? It wasn't a great idea. Or maybe it was on paper. Or maybe it wasn't executed properly. But you only have so many resources as a homebrew club to try and execute these things. Stick with what works and add new things in small doses and sort of test drive them and see what actually works for you. And then finally here, and this is the quickest part, it's about direction. It's about managing a homebrew club. And this is the part that I find kind of boring, but it is still important. Excuse me. What you absolutely need in terms of management, you need a president and you need a treasurer. You need a president because someone has to manage the activities of the club right when it starts, from the inception. Somebody has to be there to handle not just the big picture ideas about what the club's identity is, but also the day-to-day affairs of writing up agendas, communicating when meetings are happening, negotiating with the manager of the venue. And you need a treasurer because that's the person who's in charge not only of managing your money, but also organizing ideas about how to use it. In the what might be nice, if you are incorporated, you usually are required to have a board of directors, officially, who has the power to remove the president in case he or she goes insane, because they're in graduate school. What might be nice in terms of people who can help, vice presidents are good to have. We generally use them as utility infielders, special projects kind of person. Past presidents often have a role to play where they can act as keepers of institutional memory and guidance and providing ideas on, we did this 8 years ago and it didn't work out so well, or it really did. Having a secretary or a communications person to keep agendas and take notes and communicate with the club can be very handy. A steward. Oh, this is the best position to have. If you have some motivated soul willing to do this. This is someone who shows up and handles all the beer, is the person who brings all the cups and everything, manages your material needs as a club. That's a great position to have. And then we have what I would term these skill positions, which are things like your competition coordinator, your events coordinator, and these are your education coordinator. And these are going to be driven by what it is that you want to do as a club, what your motivation is in terms of your mission and your goals. But do this selectively, because it can be hard to get people to fill all these positions, which is what brings us to the next section, help wanted. Shortly before World War II, there was a report issued by Congress, and in the first paragraph of this report was one of the stupidest things Congress has ever said, and that is saying something. Because you have the president looking down the barrel of fascism in Europe, global depression, and this line says, the president needs help. Because up until that point, the presidency was basically the president, a social secretary, and a few correspondence clerks, and then the military. Like, that was it. But we realized that, hey, maybe we should expand this office a little bit. The same thing is true in homebrew clubs. Believe me when I say if you're not the president of your club, your president needs help. They really do. So how do you get that? Well, you need to start simple. You need to, first of all, start with a very simple management structure that allows you to accomplish the small goals that you set out initially. Because what you want is a series of small successes. You want every program and project you put out there to be successful at first. It builds up a pattern of successful behavior. Gradually, you can start identifying new leaders. And this is very easy to do because the new leaders in your club are the ones who are showing up to every single meeting. Those are the people who are going to be your new leaders. So focus on who shows up. And then recruit and promote them. Get them into a small role in your club. Get them into, something like being the steward is easy. You say, look, all you have to do is show up at the meeting, bring the cups. That's it. But what that does is that gets them into the material fiber of the club and how it's being run, and they start, appreciating what goes into that. And gradually they can take on larger and more important responsibilities. In the Roman Republic, we have this, the cursus honorum. It was the path of honors. This was when you would go from being in the local council up to being in the Senate, and then once you were in the Senate, you worked up to being basically a minister of public works, and then gradually you work your way up to being consul. But there was a known path, and in most effective clubs, you will see this happen. People take on a small leadership role, and then gradually take on positions of increasing responsibility. And the other group that you really want to focus on in terms of identifying new leaders is brewers and judges. People who brew a lot are reliable attendees at homebrew club meetings. They love to be there because they need to get that beer evaluated. And people who are judges have already shown a commitment to beer and brewing and a willingness to put in what is often a painful amount of work becoming a beer judge. So those are people who are destined to be committed to the success of the club because they're dedicated to the hobby. And then there's one more thing we need to talk about when it comes to help wanted. It's what we might call the human capital gap. Very often, the ambitions of people exceed their actual capabilities. That is, they think they can do quite a lot. And they're wrong. And guess who gets to pay the price for that? You and your club. This is why it's important to start people small, let them show you that they can accomplish things and go from there. Because if you just say, hey, you know, Jim seems really excited about being vice president and he is dedicated towards building up our web presence to a degree that no one has ever seen in the world from a homebrew club. And then 10 months later, after Jim's been vice president for 10 months, you still have the same one-page landing page for your homebrew club. Jim's not coming through on his end of the bargain, and not because he's not motivated, but because he lacks the skill to do it. And the tricky part there is sort of pulling them down off of that ledge without, you know, alienating them from the club. So you have to start, let them start small. Let them prove what they can do. How do we encourage participation? First of all, make meetings worthwhile. Go back to your identity and your goal and your mission and see what it is you want to do. If your club is built around education, then every meeting you should be providing some kind of beer education to your members. If it's about competition, you should be providing information about area competitions, details on inter-club and intra-club competitions, and you should have competitions right there at the meeting. So you should focus your meetings on what the goal of the club was. This is another one I love. Make idea people pull their weight. I'm sure everyone has seen people in homebrew clubs who, every meeting, they say, I have a great idea. And what their idea is to make you work. That's their idea. So over time, I developed a what I thought was a very effective response to this. I would say, oh, my, Jim, that's a great idea. You should do that and get back to us. Do the legwork, bring it back to us, and we will vote on it. Man, what a, Jim, you are, man, you are a powerhouse. You're killing it, Jim. You are doing a great job, man. And this is a no-lose scenario, because either Jim feels really motivated now and goes out and actually does kill it, or he forgets about it and you don't have to deal with the fallout. So, here's the thing, if it's a genuinely good enough idea, it will probably come up again and you can sort of work it in your own timetable. So make idea people pull their weight. Have a good blend of of member-only and open activities. There are some people who like the idea of bringing their family to a homebrew club event, but there are other people who are using this as an escape, and you know, not from their families, I'm just saying, you know, as a thing for them. You know, like, you know, like when I go out to the workshop and, you know, work with the saws and all, and I know Barbara won't ever come out. Even if I like saw my hand off, when I'm out there, I can be screaming like mad and she will never notice. So I know I'm safe out there, but I just want some quiet time by myself. So some people like that too. So try to mix it up. Have member-only events, but have events where people are welcome to come in as well. You can have data-driven activity choices. This is one I loved. I love surveys, and we survey people in Stony Creek. We do it on occasion. Here's a list of 15 events. Which ones are you interested in? And people respond to the survey, and now we have some actual data. But here's the other thing. You also need to have experience-driven activity choices, because very often when people respond to surveys, it's not that these are things they're going to do. These are things they kind of wish they were going to do. But when you put together that golf outing or ski trip or camping outing or paintball trip, I still want to do that. Can you imagine homebrewers playing paintball? I'm sorry, that just sounds like a blast to me. Oh, that'd be great. We should go do that right now. No, not now. Maybe on Thursday. But very often people like the idea of it, but when push comes to shove, they don't actually show up. So, like I said, be flexible with these things. And then there's something else. What do you do when members leave? It's going to happen sooner or later. You're going to have people who leave the club. Don't take it personally, first of all, and second of all, try and figure out why they left. Because very often, in fact, I would say probably most of the time, it has nothing to do with you. Very often, their objective life circumstances changed, and so they're not brewing as often, and therefore they're not showing up at the meetings. And that's fine. But sometimes it's going to be that they weren't getting what they thought they were getting, and that's valuable information, especially if you're in a club that's going through a rough patch, because that'll help you sort of adjust your behavior. Finally here, goes, oh, man, look, just killing it on time. I've got like 98 seconds. This is perfect. Sorry, I get proud of myself when that happens. I teach, so, you know, you're constantly trying to hit a specific number. So now I'm wasting the time, and I'm going to run over. Be patient with your club. Be persistent. Keep going. Because what's going to happen is you're going to start with maybe 7 or 8 people or 10 or 12 people, and you're going to be stuck at that number for a year. And you're not going to have any new members. Or maybe you're going to gain members, but you're going to lose them at the same rate. Keep going. Keep pushing. Because what will happen is you'll hit a period of time where all of a sudden, you know, there's a big, you know, beer festival or something, and a bunch of people see a homebrew club there, and they go onto the HA's website, and they search for clubs, and all of a sudden you'll pick up 5 or 6 new members in a one-month period. And now all of a sudden you're a little larger. And maybe the same thing happens a year later, except now you've got more members, and they've been telling people as well. And so now you go from 15 to 30. And then you go from 30 to 50. So be patient. It will happen. It just sometimes takes a lot of time, and you have to be willing to tolerate meetings with 4 and 5 people, which, by the way, might be some of your best meetings. You might look back nostalgically on when it was just a few people sitting around a table. Also, if things are stagnant, don't be afraid to reset. I mean, just blow up the whole organization and start with a whole new organizational structure. Have a retreat with all your members and say, guys and gals, this isn't working. What should we be doing? What do you want to do? Because maybe your club has changed, maybe the ground has shifted under your feet, and you don't even know it yet. And be in touch with your brewing community. Homebrewers are a very supportive group. And not only that, but if you have people who also become BJCP judges, if they work at or know people who work at the local homebrew shop, if they are themselves owners and operators of homebrew shops, if they work at breweries because be part of that larger community, and you'll find it a lot easier to get access to the resources you might need, the support you need, new members, ingredients, activities, it all helps. Be a part of that community. And be confident in what you're doing. As I said, it does take persistence. And this last little bullet point here is if. It's one of my favorite poems by Rudyard Kipling, If. I'm sure you've all heard this one. This is when, if you can keep your head while all about you are losing theirs and blaming you for it, then you can trust yourself when all others doubt you. And that's true. But most people forget that next line. The next line of that poem is, but make allowance for their doubting too. Which means that you should absolutely be confident. Work hard in the direction you believe the club should go, but always be willing to take a step back and pivot and adjust and react. And if you can do those things, then this institutional club that you've built is going to be around for a very long time. So thank you very much for your attention. If anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to field them. Thank you.
Josh, would you back up to that giving slide, please?
There we are.
There it is. That last line there, the issue of giving, that's what the Radagast Award was written around being. That is an awesome thing. Myself and the members of the governing committee believe that that is the premier award to get in this whole conference.
Agreed.
That is the premier award. It is not a big club award. It is for all clubs. And the issue, what you've seen two big clubs, is who has given us the data, who has entered into that. But that's what that award is about. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for the reminder.
Josh, thanks. We're lucky enough to have Josh in our backyard, so he'll be out to visit our club shortly.
Literally, I just live in their backyard.
Literally, yeah.
It's a rough patch. I don't want to get into the details.
But there's beer brewed in the house, so we let them. So I've been involved in nonprofits for 10 or 15 years, and you made one comment that I just want to expand on a little bit. You mentioned kind of in passing, hey, you could be the steward. Look, it really doesn't take that much. And I just give you one warning about recruiting volunteers, and that is don't ever undersell the level of commitment you need from them. So, really think through if it's going to be an hour a month you need them involved or 3 hours a month. But it really helps them if they know exactly what time commit they're making. I mean, you know, exactly. But don't say, hey, this is easy. You know, even you can do it. Make sure that they have a good set of expectations.
Yeah, and, so, unless it is easy.
So, yeah, and like, well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's still easy, but yeah. So as you get the point, is just be careful because you don't want them to be dissatisfied right out of the gate by, oh man, I had to put 6 hours just to get prepped for this meeting and ruin it for them. But,
oh, I agree, 100%. I would also say that I forgot to mention in that section one good way to encourage and promote leaders is to meet with them individually and independently, gauge their interest, and give them the opportunity. Don't do it in front of everybody. You don't want peer pressure deciding this. And that's especially true when you're talking about succession in your more, heavy positions. When you're talking about a new president or a new treasurer, or a new vice president, or a new competition organizer, talk to them and try to establish, what they're willing to do over time. Because when you have a clear sense of who's in charge now, who's going to be in charge next, who's going to be in charge, 10 years from now, everybody feels a little more secure when you have that line of succession established. So it's worth doing.
So my club just got started up, and we're kind of in that whole charismatic phase right now. It started up by me and a friend, and now we've shot from 3 people to like 10 people.
Yep.
So I actually have 2 questions for you. The first one is, you mentioned incorporation. What incorporation type do most clubs use is my first question.
I'm not sure there's a one that predominates. Generally speaking, they fall into either 501c3 or 501c7. Okay. C3 is a traditional tax-exempt nonprofit. Usually they incorporate under the rationale that they provide an educational service. Okay. The other is 501c7, which is a social club. And the biggest distinction between those two is that a 501c3 is going to require all of your events and activities to be open to the public. A 501c7, a social club, is actually exactly the opposite. It requires you to be exclusive, that you're not offering anything to the general public. And each of these incorporation chapters comes with its own sort of tweaks and regulations and guidelines. For example, 501c3s can take in almost unlimited amounts of money in donations, and it's all tax exempt. Social clubs can take in 25% above and beyond whatever their dues are for the year, unless it's a non-recurring expense. So if you get a windfall of somebody offers you $1,000 to help out at a beer dinner for your club, that's not a recurring thing, so that's still going to be exempt. But each has different little regulations. But the 501c chapter there, you can read through all those. And there are only three or four that would apply to a Hoover club.
And my second question was, how do you handle interaction between the club and then getting those people to get AHA memberships or that kind of thing? Because my whole club right now, I'm the only AHA member in there, and I've been trying to sell it and trying to get them to bite in. But how do you guys go about that? Do you have bylaws that require them to have that membership?
No, we've actually never required it. Most of our members always have been AHA members. I find that most people come to their club after about a year to 2 years of brewing, and the data bears that out as well, incidentally. At that point, most people within their first couple of years of homebrewing tend to join the AHA. It's a relatively low-cost endeavor. It gives you access to the discounts and Zymergy and everything else. As that environment, and especially informationally, as that information environment gets more competitive, there might be people who would rather spend that money on a craft beer and brewing subscription than on the AHA. We've never explicitly gone on recruiting drives, but I would say the easiest way to sell it would be if you have a number of places in your area that are doing part of the discount program. Because if you tell them, look, you go to Iron Hill Brewery, two, three times a month, this thing's going to pay for itself inside of 3 months. That's a very easy way to sell that.
Part of my thought process was it's hard to provide all that info. We're focused on
please, on the mic.
Sorry.
Otherwise, we don't get it for posterity.
Sorry about that. So our club is really education focused. So one of the things is, I'm trying to use that AHA membership to try to get the educational materials and things like that for them, so that way the club, me, is not having to provide all of that all the time.
Sure.
You get what I mean?
Absolutely.
So, thank you.
My pleasure.
So this is really a recommendation kind of question. Our club, with its purpose, we are educational-based, learning-based, giving back, and there's a core group of, I'd say, 10 members. We've expanded over years, even since I started 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we've become very social, and it's almost getting out of hand. We're getting too many people who just show up. It's like, oh, hey, free beer, get to talk to people.
Yes. Yeah.
And then you have the core commitment group of members who are meeting the other values. Not to weed out, but how can you make sure that you can embrace? Because there's some new members who are coming around, and I can tell you they get turned off because it's like, well, you're coming and people are just drinking and talking,
right,
and there's no education into it. So, what are some good ways to not alienate, but, do it in a more subtle kind of way so you can succeed?
Sure. This is an area where right from the beginning at Stony Creek we were very particular about it because we knew, much like you said, we were going to be a committed group to making
right.
brewers better, that we weren't there for drinking. It was incidental to what we were doing. Right from the outset, we didn't exactly screen our members, but anybody who contacted the club about membership, I or one of the other officers sat down with them somewhere outside of a meeting and just talked to them about brewing and beer and what the club was and what they could expect and if they liked that and if that was what they were shooting for. I found that those meetings were enough to identify the serious brewers, and the ones that weren't were kind of intimidated by it and felt like it wouldn't be all that much fun, so that kind of kept them away passively.
Right.
Another thing you can do, which is something we flirt with but haven't had to actually implement yet, we have a plan to actually cap membership. We have a plan in place that basically the board authorized a provision in our bylaws that said if our dues paid membership in any given year rose above 50, that at that point the membership committee could actually impose caps. And all existing members would have the opportunity to renew, but at that point we could actually use criteria and bylaws laid out sort of what would make for a higher, more qualified member. or not, and we would have an application period. And it's the kind of thing that you can do even if it's already gotten a little out of hand. And with new members coming in, don't just have the homebrew shop or whoever it is just say, yeah, just show up any day, any Tuesday, third Tuesday of the month. You can say that what they need to do is contact the club first. In terms of promoting a sense of purpose at the meetings, the best way is probably to remove the meeting from the place where the beer and all is being served, whether it's the stuff you've brought or if it's stuff you buy at your location. If you can have the meeting upstairs, out of the way, because that way, you know, people can only buy beer at breaks or right when they first get there or in between events. And that might go along that way to sort of keep everybody on track.
All right, thank you.
Also, it might not hurt if, because again, you want to give the members what they want. It might not hurt to have explicitly social meetings versus explicitly business meetings versus explicitly evaluation meetings as well.
Yeah, so like almost like in every other month, like you'd have like more of a social meeting. And
sure.
Then next month is, okay, we're going to do some educational things. We're going to have, you know, head brewer from this brewery come in, do a demonstration on, you know, whatever it is that, you know, we can come up with and, you know, really get the members to embrace.
And the other advantage, that's exactly right, and the other advantage of that is that if you, that then can become a mechanism to sort of, you know, ease out those other members, because you can just simply, in the course of scheduling, schedule fewer purely social meetings until you hit the number that you're comfortable with, and then we'll see if they stick around.
Yep. All right, thank you.
My pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the comment was that meetings can be divided, and we do the same thing. We do education first, and then we have a break, then we do business, then we have a break, then we do evaluation, and then after that it's social. And that can come in handy. And also, when your club reaches a certain size, it may be beneficial to have a separate meeting for your officers alone to sort of hash out the details of business, and then at the general meeting for your club, just offer it for ratification. So that you don't sort of get bogged down in a two-hour discussion of how many hot dogs and of what type you're going to have at the picnic. Because we're homebrewers, you know it would get really deep.
I hope it's not too repetitive, but I'm glad the idea of education versus social and the conflict that can sometimes come up in a homebrew club came up. But are there factors that you've seen where you identify, maybe like if you're to play homebrew doctor and diagnose issues that could come up with clubs where all of a sudden there's a trend that you're noticing that maybe you think this could actually be bad for our club in the future, we should maybe pull back from this, or maybe we should like realign ourselves? So the question, I guess, is what kind of things have you seen that maybe you should avoid or identify in clubs that could potentially be bad for them as an organization?
This should be fun, is what I would say. When people aren't having fun at meetings, they're not going to come. They're going to find other places to get their fun. And if that means finding a way to make evaluating beer fun, then that's what we need to do, if what you're doing is not working for your members. And you can tell. If you look around the room and you see a lot of yawning and nodding off and attendance starts to drop off, you should absolutely be tracking your attendance at every meeting. That'll give you a very good measure, a good metric of the health of your club. And you can do it by absolute numbers. You can do it by percentage of members. Just identify how many are active and whether it's the same 15 people every time. And, you know, maybe you need to sort of broaden your appeal, or maybe if it's because, you know, you're only appealing to that segment. So,
thank you.
Yeah, that's probably the best thing I could say. Make sure everybody's leaving with a smile on their face.
So my question is about flying under the radar. So I belong to a regular homebrew club, just like you're describing. But at the same time, I work at a company. There's a couple of us who are homebrewers, and we meet occasionally on Fridays. We have an email list, and it's really a social event, which won't grow out of proportion because it's limited by the members, you know,
sure,
who attend. So my concern is, you know, right now it's flying under the radar. We're using company space. It's after hours. But there's no official club organization. There's no endorsement by management or anything like that. It's just going along. And I'm questioning as to what drivers would I look for in order to say, I need to formalize this, we need to have a president, we need to incorporate, you know, register as a social club, all those things that you described before. What kind of criteria would you use to decide when it's that time to make it more than just a group of people sitting around having beer?
I would say when either your desires as a club to engage in more formal activities or larger activities starts to outweigh the pain in the ass that is. And that's when you know you need to maybe make it a more formal structure. Unless it's a one-off. If you just say, oh, well, you know, my nephew's getting married in 2 months and I'd like all of us to get together and brew beer, that's a one-off event. That's not going
right,
to repeat.
Right.
But if you say we'd like to, you know, learn more in a structured way, or we want to hold a BJCP training class, when you start getting those impulses to do larger events, that's probably the time. I would also say it seems kind of inherently dangerous to me to hold a homebrew club meeting in your workplace. But that, I'm not judging. I'm just saying that's gutsy.
It's a group of people who respond to an email list, which is on one of the company servers. You know, it's a very informal structure per se, so we don't really call it a homebrew club, although it was a couple of homebrewers who got it started, you know, and we're educating a lot of people. You know, the first meeting, every beer tasted like beer to most of the people. Now people can actually tell the difference between an IPA and a stout.
That's awesome.
There's education going on as part of that, but that's, I think, the social and that educational part is what we're looking for.
I understood.
Thanks.
I'm going to add a little bit to the response here in that I'm a member of a club that is a 501c7 in Michigan that's an LLC, because that structure makes sense in Michigan.
Yep.
So you got to watch that. So we have a formal structure, president, vice president, board, the whole bit. I'm involved in another club, Ann Arbor's Brewers Guild, that has no officers, has no structure. We just have committed members that just managed to get things done. And those of you that saw, types of things that we do is there at club night.
Yeah.
Ann Arbor's Brewers Guild has 3 active members present on the governing committee.
Wow.
That's out of 15 nationally. A 4th one works for Dogfish Head that came from the club. So, you don't need a formal structure to be solid.
Yeah. All right, great. Thank you.
I have a question about just group communications in general. Email, by many people is considered passé and something that would have been used maybe 10 years ago. You've got, some folks who, say, okay, social media, such as Facebook, what have you, are great ways. And then there's those that say, absolutely not, I'm not on social media.
Right.
Our club, we tried, a mechanism called Meetup. And again, it's very spotty. And what you end up with is you don't always get the communication to the same groups of people, especially the ones that you want to know. We'll hold an event. Oh, I didn't know that it was happening. Mm-hmm. Because it's more of a pull, type of a mechanism than a push. How do you, what is, seems to be the consensus as to what works best that you could capture, all of that versus, really what we're trying to do is, I guess, herd cats.
Sure. We maintain I don't do it anymore, but what I assume is a very detailed email list for all of our members. And what we do is after the general meeting every month, they get a wrap-up of that meeting with bulleted points of things that require action or notification for the membership.
So actual minutes sent out afterwards?
They're modified minutes. We keep minutes, but incorporates elements of that, but they get, top-line information where this is the stuff you need to be aware of, upcoming events, changes, things we need your feedback on, things like that. And we also, in addition to that, we also do use Facebook. And you're right, you don't catch everyone with that, but it seems that the members who do use it really appreciate it, just as a forum to get together to, to share information, to ask questions. So that seems to be something that works as well.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
I guess I'm in a little different situation than some of the other people that talked. Our club is pretty large, and we've been around for a long time, but I'm starting to notice a lot of drop-off, especially at the older members that have been there for almost 20 years that are super knowledgeable that I'd like to try to get back out.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any tips or anything like that to try to get them back out?
Sure. I don't want to sound underhanded, but flattery is great. Put together events that call on their expertise. Have them, schedule a talk on the history of the club or, the earlier days of homebrewing. Because, 20 years ago, homebrewing was like the Wild West, terms of getting it done. Nowadays, we're sort of spoiled with access to everything. But, there may very well be things that they know or would be interesting to the club that you can use to kind of pull them back in. And you can also try to set up programs. One that we tried to establish, but we weren't large enough to make it functional, was a mentoring program when new members who had not been brewing very long, you know, came to the club. We were going to assign them a mentor, or someone who had been in the club and had been brewing for a while, and try to pair people off, people with similar brewing interests, try and create an immediate attachment to the club. But at the same time, that, you know, calls the old war horses back into service.
And I guess the other thing to share with you, I guess, that's worked really well is similar to the mentor program is we did friendship brews, and then we have a competition with that. So like a 3 or 4 man team gets, you enter in and you get picked from a hat, and then you compete. That's done really well for us. So just to share that.
Sure.
We are running a little bit long. This is the last question.
I was just wondering if you had any specific tips for burnout. So not people who have left necessarily, but people who are still around, still believe in everything that's happening, has happened, and has just kind of gotten a little bit overextended, and how to sort of cultivate and rehabilitate, the enthusiasm. I know you had a section there about stagnation and you suggested step back and go back to what works. But I don't know if you could expand upon that a little bit for just motive, just energy,
Sure.
Motivation's still there, but the energy is kind of, yeah.
I would say talk to people that are in that situation and ask them if you could work on any project, if there's one thing you could do for the club, what would that be? And let them work on a passion project, something that they really care about, and try to find institutional support for that if it's a bigger job than one person can handle. But I'd say that'd be the easiest way to do it. Because burnout usually happens when people are doing the same thing over and over again and they're just tired of it. Giving them an opportunity to break that routine and re-engage with something that they actually enjoy doing just for its own sake would be a great way to, sort of clear their head and get them focused again. But it's usually the result of somebody with just too many balls in the air, and it's all they can do. You see this with presidents a lot. They're writing agendas, they're chairing meetings, they're writing minutes, they're organizing activities, and there's just too much. So I'd say try to relieve those burdens and then let them focus on something that they actually want to do.
Thank you all. Let's give it up for Josh. I thought that was a great presentation.